Paranormal King Radio Network at ParanormalKing.com.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of August 21st, 2018. And this is episode number 365. And this is your host, as always, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Well, it was an interesting week for me. And today, yes, is August 21st. You might remember last year was a kind of an important day. It was the Great American Eclipse. And I traveled down south to be in the path of... I don't know if you'd call it the what you'd call it, but it was crazy. It was exciting, and I'll tell you what, that memory will last me a lifetime. I was kind of smart about this. I actually drove down to, I live in Northeast Ohio, so I live near, kind of between Akron and Cleveland, so not anywhere near the path of totality. So I had to drive down south, but what I did was, the day prior, I went down to Cincinnati to kind of sit and watch the weather patterns, and then that morning made my way down south to be able to be in that path of totality, and me and a lot of other people. It was wall-to-wall people, but I'll tell you what, it was worth it. I had to drive home quickly to be back at work in the morning, but I'll tell you what, it was definitely worth it. It was a chance of a lifetime, but actually won't have to travel too far for the next big American eclipse in a couple of years because it's going to go right in my backyard, literally. So I'm looking forward to that. But again, happy anniversary to the Great American Eclipse. It might be one of those stories like, where were you during the Great American Eclipse? And of course, everyone's going to claim that they were right in the middle of it, but I was. I got the pictures to prove it. The other big thing that's happened to me during the week, you might have noticed, well, maybe you didn't notice. And if you didn't notice, well, shame on you, but I wasn't uploading any stories last week after Wednesday. I think I had Wednesday's story pop in there. But after that, all the stories that I talked about last week on the show, August 14th show, didn't get published. And there's a reason for that. I lost my computer. I didn't lose it. It didn't run away, but had a little problem with it. It had a meltdown, and I lost everything. Pretty much entire hard drive, was not able to recover it in the last 6 days of working on it and trying to implant it into other computers and trying to extract the information and so on and so forth. So I sit behind a brand new computer, and hopefully that quality of sound is there too, that crispness that I bring you each and every week. But really disappointed. I thought, I could escape the woes of computer problems. I wasn't connected to the cloud very well, so I did lose a lot of stuff that was not connected, including a lot of my graphics for this brand new website and brand new logo I have for the Paranormal News Insider and a lot of other stuff surrounding with the show, including all of this year's and all of last year's archives. But yikes. I'll get it back. I'm not worried about it. Most everything else is still there, and including this week's show, which is going to have some really, really interesting news. We're going to talk about grandstanding or withstanding. I know that doesn't make any sense, but trust me, in a minute, it will. And will the case for Squatch be heard? That's part of this grandstanding or withstanding story. Maybe you might know what I'm talking about. And just how does one find a Squatch anyway? We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about another lost creature found. And we'll discuss On the Wings of Truth and the famous radio dish is going to be replaced by a camel. I know that doesn't make any sense, but again, it will make these crazy headlines. These are called teasers in the business, and it gets you to stick around a little longer and listen to what I got to say. And we'll also, probably the saddest story this week, we're going to talk about another anomalous researcher passes away. We've lost another pioneer. And it just seems like, gosh, music and everywhere, we're losing all these famous people. I guess that's just part of getting older. Everybody that I looked up to, just kind of passes away. But that's just that's life. We're born, we make accomplishments, and then we become famous after we're gone. That's just how things are. But not this guy. Not this guy. So once again, one of the things I always talk about at the beginning of every show is the events listing that I have on ParanewsInsider.com. You can check it out. You go to the website, ParanewsInsider.com. Click on the events tab at the top. I do my best to bring you the biggest events and some of the smaller events as well that I think are going to get put on without being canceled and me forgetting to take them off or not knowing to take them off. Ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, whatever the focus is of that event, that's where you're going to find it listed under. And I love these things. Obviously, I do. I talk about them all the time. And I also like speaking at these events as well. And speaking of cryptozoology, I'll actually just finished putting together a speaking arrangement for September 30th. And it's going to be focused on cryptids with an Ohio focus. And that's going to be at the Floyd E. Youngkin branch of the Pickaway County Public Library in Asheville, Ohio. It's going to be on Sunday, September 30th. And I'll be there from 2 to 4 p.m., which is nice because they close at 5. It gives me a little bit of overlap. Typically, I get locked in the libraries and I have to tunnel my way out to get out of them. But after I read about 50, 60 books, just kidding. I really enjoy the libraries, and this is, I've been in this area before, and I'll be back to this area again next June to the main public library, the Pickaway County Public Library, which is actually in Circleville, and I'll be talking about UFOs next year. I'm really excited about that, but I have a whole bunch of cryptid stuff coming up the rest of the year, October 5th and 6th. I'll be at the UNCON 12, and UNCON stands for unconventional. It's an unconventional convention, which is really interesting. That's going to take place in Piqua, Ohio, and I'll be talking about cryptozoology as part of their theme for this event, which is really just a random event. It's about movies and comic books and you name it, anything that you're into. If you're a geek like me, you're into a lot of stuff, you're going to love this event. And the theme of the show this year is Alien Freak Show. So I'll fit right in. October 13th, the following weekend, I'll be presenting at the Albatwitch Festival in Columbia, Pennsylvania, along with fellow speakers Tim Renner and Rick Fisher. Just three of us, but we can carry it. Three of us, I know we're going to put on a great show. You're going to want to tune in. That's all the way on the right-hand side of Pennsylvania. So that's the eastern side of Pennsylvania. We're just north of Baltimore there. So hopefully going to be a lot of people there. And I'm really looking forward to that. I haven't been out in that area speaking since I was in Maryland probably 4 or 5 years ago. So I'm really excited about that. I'm also excited. I'm already putting together events for 2019. And I'm barely even trying. But it's exciting that people want me to speak at all these events. But there's one in particular that I'm really excited about. I don't know. Maybe I've mentioned this once or twice. I don't know. The PA Bigfoot Camping Adventure, does that sound familiar? No. Well, it should, because I've been talking about it every week. And the last couple of years, I talked about it for the last few weeks. May 31st through June 2nd, 2019, at the Benner's Meadow Run Campground in Farmington, Pennsylvania. And the reason why I'm talking about it so early is that tickets are going to go on sale September 1st. And September 1st, by the way, is my actual birthday. Not today. It's September 1st. So I'm excited that tickets go on sale on Saturday, September 1st, which is actually when I was born on Saturday, which is really weird. But you're going to want to get these tickets fast. Get them quick. They are going to go fast. There's only Eric Altman, who's hosting the event, put out there, I think there's only 500 tickets that are going to be sold. But you want to get them early because you'll get a little bit of a discount. And I think he's only made one announcement. The Mountain Monsters will be back. They were there last year. The whole entire cast was there last year. But there's going to be some other big named people. And that's where I'm going to leave it right there. I'm not going to say who. I'm not going to say what or where, what they're from. I don't know. Could be from a UFO show. I don't know. Could be from anything. Who knows? But you're going to want to tune into that. So check it out. Find it on Facebook. PA Bigfoot Camping Adventure. Again, May 31st through June 2nd. But tickets are going to go on sale in just a couple of weeks. September 1st. And if you do get tickets, you're going to have to go through that website, PABigfootCampingAdventure.com. And you'll also want to get with Benner's Meadow Ranch Campground. They're not responsible for selling the tickets, but that's where it's going to be. There might be some spots left. I don't know. I know I got my spot. I'm excited about that as well. You can camp out. They have cabins. They have. There's a lot of places surrounding that area that you can stay. But you're going to want to hurry up and get that stuff booked. This is going to be a big event, folks, and that's why I'm talking about it now. So PABigfootCampingAdventure.com. Next year, tickets go on sale very, very soon. But enough of that. You came here for the news, even though I think that is big news. Cryptid news. This is quite the saga this story is turning into. It's been going on for a while now, and this guy just won't quit. Just won't quit. He's one of those guys that, I don't know, maybe we could do without. Maybe we couldn't. I don't know, but you be the judge. I'll be the jury, I guess. I'll be the judge. You be the jury. Maybe that's how it should work out here. The guy's name is Todd Standing. Yeah, so you might know this guy. Yes, the saga behind Todd Standing continues, and it continues in the British Columbia court system. Right now, 560-plus wildfires are raging out of control, and the province of British Columbia has issued a state of emergency. But meanwhile, last Tuesday, August 14th, Todd Standing, producer of the documentary Discovering Bigfoot, which if you've not seen it, I don't know if it's still there, but it was on Netflix. And it took me probably 2 weeks to watch it. Not because it was that interesting, because it wasn't that interesting. And that came out last year. And, well, he's in court now. And what he's trying to do is have the right to provide his argument that, yes, Sasquatch does indeed exist. So the big thing here, if you've read about this story, they really focus on him being able to prove that Sasquatch exists. But really and truly, this actually boils down to that his livelihood and credibility has been damaged due to the, quote, non-recognition of Sasquatch, unquote. Yeah, so the fact that the Department of Wildlife for British Columbia has not recognized Bigfoot, that's hurt him. Made him look like a fool. Yeah, it wasn't all the other things he did. Anyway, this is a civil lawsuit, which means Standing is trying to hold someone accountable for a wrong. The wrong here is that the Fish and Wildlife refuses to believe the existence of information and evidence, and I use the word evidence with air quotes, collected in accounts of people seeing this creature as validation. The way he's doing this is not really good, in my opinion. I don't think it's the appropriate path to take, but he's just trying to really get attention for this matter, and he's going to be doing this in other places as well, Alberta, Canada, Montana, as well as California. So this is kind of the warm-up here out in British Columbia by suing the province of British Columbia. The lawsuit was filed late last October and is now entering the system. Standing wants the court to hear his evidence, which includes his documentary, as well as testimony by PhDs. And Standing says in his YouTube video, that's really entertaining, by the way, that if this case gets before a judge, he will, quote, prove beyond any reasonable doubt with PhDs testifying, fishery officers, police officers, nurses, engineers, will all come eyewitnesses accounting like unreal, spectacular, unreal accountings, and my footage and Jeff Meldrum's evidence, Jim Chilcott's fingerprint analysis, which is unreal and amazing, and the DNA that exists. If this case goes to trial, I will blow this case out of the water. The evidence to prove this species exists is way beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, I have PhDs that are going to come out and testify that I took them out and showed them a Sasquatch, for God's sake. I'm going to put my documentary on trial. Unquote. And we would drop a mic in the woods if we could, but we won't. We're going to hold on to that mic because we're going to need it for a minute. So Stanley goes on to say during this little YouTube rant that his documentary is legit, despite a lot of people questioning it and saying that the and also saying that his court case is not a waste of time, as it is the quote. And again, I quote, discovery of the bloody millennium, unquote. He says he's not asking for money or damages through this court case. He just wants a biologist to accompany him for 3 months so he can prove the Sasquatch is real. 3 months. I don't know who's going to pay for that. Well, Todd's intentions, I mean, they're admirable. I get it. I'm not against what he's trying to do. I think for me, it's more or less the way he's going about it. The things that he's saying, he is making it kind of about himself, really more than it is about Sasquatch. And I really wonder what his true motives are. And, you know, I might get in trouble for this, but I really don't care. I think maybe part of this could be his mental state as well. I don't know. People go a little crazy in this field, and we all want to be believed. You know, maybe he does know that there's things going on. And this again is something that people have attacked him for, his Netflix little movie, I guess you'd call it, his documentary, is that a lot of people are saying a lot of that stuff is made up. And maybe it is. And maybe he did have a real encounter out there, but you know, he's trying to convince people now that what he saw was real because he believes what he saw is real. So we can't take that away from him. But I think that there's some other stuff going on here. And we've seen this. And the reason why I'm saying this is we've seen this throughout the years from Mr. Standing and some not so upstanding evidence and stuff that's come out surrounding him and his group of people that he's have running amok in the woods. Yeah, I think playing a victim, putting himself out there as a victim is really one of the worst approaches he could have taken, but maybe that was advice from his lawyers. I don't know, because it does get you attention. I mean, he's been in the news many, many times over his dozen-year career and has been highly suspect of creating several hoaxes along the way. I mean, I'm not going to pull punches here. It's true. I'm not making that up. His so-called evidence has been shredded by others, including those who aren't even experts. These are people that sit behind computers all day. And they've ripped them apart for some of this stuff. And these people, again, aren't experts. They're not PhDs in specific fields. So Standing has put himself out there in the public as a Sasquatch researcher. And just because he believes in something doesn't make it true. And, you know, he can talk about negativity and you know, making things hard for himself. He put himself out there. It wasn't British Columbia. And just because they don't back him up on it, no one else has backed up the existence of Bigfoot in the, gosh, what, 70-plus years that people have really been searching for this thing? I mean, no one's proven it. No one's said, okay, we believe you. You don't see people suing for that. It's a little crazy. It's kind of like a five-year-old wanting someone to sit in their living room because they believe Santa Claus is real. I just keep an eye on those cookies. That's all I got to say about that. You know, again, I'm not bashing the possibility of Bigfoot existing, and I'm not saying what he's doing is completely wrong. Again, just kind of the way he's going about it. But I just don't think that this is the spokesman that this field needs, and a lot of other people should be kind of worried about how this is going to harm us and harm those that are trying to do some good work out there in the field of cryptozoology and, I guess, of Bigfootology. I mean, I'm in favor of Bigfoot since it's such a big deal all over the world. It should be kind of a subsection of cryptozoology. That's how I feel about it. I mean, you got the Yeti, the Yeren, the Almas. I mean, so many different types of big type creatures and even smaller creatures all over the world that fits this Bigfoot type of creature. Why not have its own kind of thing there? So Todd can be the king of the Bigfootologists. Well, I mean, even if this thing does get to court, I highly doubt any of this evidence will ever be taken seriously with anyone in a court system. You're not gonna pull the wool over their eyes. You're not gonna be able to fool a bunch of internet people that follow these kind of stories that unfortunately fall for a lot of things that they shouldn't. You're talking about a court system that deals with murders, that deals with DNA evidence, that deals with real forensics. You know, and forensics is a collection of data and information that can be withheld up in a court of law. I don't think that there's that good of evidence out there at Bigfoot. People have collected some really interesting things that are really hard to argue, but you got to have the rest of the creature to validate. You can't just say, well, I got this cool print. That's not enough to prove that it exists, unfortunately. We got to have a little bit more, especially with something that's completely unprecedented. Now, despite this mountain of evidence he claims to have that's going to prove that these creatures exist, he seems to have very little to prove that his livelihood or credibility has been damaged by this whole thing. I mean, really, you don't have to look too far. You look on his website. He charges $4,800 per person to an accompany him on a camping trip to find Sasquatch in his own backyard. And you're responsible for pretty much everything. I think he buys you lunch. But that's it. And I think he lets you borrow his gear, but some of his equipment. But that's about it. It's a lot of money. He drives you to and from the airport, I guess. So that's pretty good. Right. It seems like a pretty good gig there. And with all the attention he's gotten over the years, especially through this particular story, he's not hiding from this. He's not denying any kind of press information. But he's put himself out there. This isn't the British Columbia court system putting him out there. He claims he's been ridiculed because the province won't back him up. Never mind that most of his evidence, again, is pretty highly suspect to begin with. And the last thing here is we should ask, is a court really the right place to prove that Bigfoot exists? We don't have this with other animals. No animal discovery that I can remember, including one that I'm going to talk about here tonight, has had to go through the court system to be validated. Ministry of Attorney General article student Marina Goodwin said it best. She said, quote, "It's possibly a matter for legislature or executive, but to determine whether or not the province should recognize a species of animals is, with the greatest of respect, not a matter for the courts to decide," unquote. Justice Kenneth Ball, who is presiding over the decision, has heard both sides, but the last I heard, he's not come to a conclusion. Now, I saw some websites say that it was dismissed, but I've not seen the evidence to prove that yet. Now, he states his decision will come later in writing at a later date, but so far I've not seen this come out anywhere. Standing will soon attempt, again, the same case will be in Alberta, as well as Montana and the state of California, which they had previously had a lawsuit all set up with, I believe her name is Melissa Hoovy, I believe, who had her own little story here that I talked about on the Paranormal News Insider. Her daughter, young daughter, filmed a Bigfoot in a tree. That's a really suspect story there, if you remember me talking about that one. I don't know. This is a going to be an interesting story to see how this turns out. But is, you know, some of the questions are coming up. People are accusing this of being some sort of grand conspiracy to hide Bigfoot or keep this from undercover from losing money from the logging industry and all these other deep things. But I really don't think that's true. I really don't think that's true. I mean, is this just a grandstanding scheme by Stanning to gain attention? Are his beliefs clouded by his judgment? Or is he really the only one who's able to contact these creatures and prove they exist? I don't know. Time's going to tell. But it's my feeling that despite getting this out in the public, this is really going to do no good for the public opinion, not just about Bigfoot, but about all of us, the Bigfoot researchers. There's a question in the chat room about the alligator that ate the woman protecting her dog in South Carolina. I read about that, and that's pretty sad situation. I just kind of glanced at that article. I didn't really plan on talking about that, but it's pretty scary. You know, those I've gotten pretty close down there in southern Florida to some of those alligators, and I'll tell you what. I would do everything to protect my dog as well. I'm certain of that, but wow. I'm not sure about, 8 foot long? 8 foot long alligator. Wow. That's quite the suitcase and pair of boots there. That's a lot of alligator. What else do I have? Well, I got a couple of other cryptid stories here. But we talk about Bigfoot all the time. We talk about court cases, and we talk about sightings, and we talk about all these fabulous things about Bigfoot. But how does one go about searching for one? That's a question. It's kind of the topic of an interesting piece I just saw a couple of days ago published in the Seattle Magazine online. And granted, you have to understand, it's not a serious piece of work. It's just an interesting little article to put some tips into perspective. And one could ask, well, maybe we don't have to look too far to figure out how to look for Bigfoot. I mean, there's a TV show for that, right? Finding Bigfoot. Should be like Looking for Bigfoot, or you can't call it Searching for Bigfoot because that's actually the name of a company by another person that we're not going to talk about. But actually, that's funny because the person that they contacted for this article, it's actually part of the source. It comes from a person. Her name is Renee Holland. And it may sound familiar because Holland, of course, if you didn't know, she was one of the hosts of the Animal Planet show Finding Bigfoot. Well, Holland offers up her 7 pieces of advice. Very simple stuff here. Number one, follow the history. Plan your search for areas where most reported sightings occur, wooded settings in Pierce County and in the Cascade Foothills, of course, in Washington State. Number two, dress for a deep forest hike. Bring a headlamp, bug spray, and good hiking gear so you can comfortably follow any leads. Such clues could include tracks, hair, nesting sites, and things like split trees. Bigfoot believers say tree damage indicates Bigfoot territory. Number three, stop and listen. Beyond visual clues, listen for Bigfoot vocalizations. Sasquatch speech is said to sound like, well, Chewbacca, a mix between a bear growl and a human yell, which is pretty accurate. Number four, leave the perfume at home. It is believed that Sasquatch has a very strong sense of smell, so limit strong odors to keep yourself as undetectable as possible and gain maximum tracking potential. Number five, set out at night. Sasquatch is believed to be more active in the dark. Number six, use the buddy system. Teaming up with another person is smart and more fun, and two sets of eyes expand the range of your survey. And last but not least, number seven, record your observations. If you happen to encounter Bigfoot, stay calm, keep your distance, and try to avoid confrontation. Snap a photo, and make sure it's not blurry. After the creature passes, describe your encounter or sketch what you saw in a field journal. Check the area for hair and other evidence, and report your findings to the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. Some good advice, but let me add a little bit to this. think he probably knew I was going to do that. Let's go back to number one. Follow the history. This is kind of a little pet peeve of mine, because you have to understand that historical sightings, even weeks or days prior to you going out and looking for this thing, it does not necessarily mean a Bigfoot is definitely in the area. Many reports are misinterpretation, misidentification, or even sometimes hoaxes. People make stuff up. Yes, they sometimes make stuff up. And if you're going to go into an area with a lot of Bigfoot sightings, you're going to go in more than likely with preconceived notions that you're going to encounter a Bigfoot, and it may lead you in the wrong direction. But then again, I mean, yes, being in an area where sightings that seem to be somewhat legitimate over the course of time, well, it might not be a bad place to start. Number two, dress for a deep forest hike. She mentions bug spray. Well, bug spray kind of goes against number four on this list. A lot of these contain perfumes. They want it to smell good, so they want you to buy it. So that kind of goes against it. Not saying that you don't want to use bug spray, because trust me, if you're going to be out in the deep woods, or I should say the deep forest, like she says, yeah, you're going to need some bug spray. And you're also going to need some tick spray as well. If you don't want to smell like an animal, or I'm sorry, if you don't want to smell like a human, you're going to have to act like an animal. Granted, there are eco-friendly and homemade versions of bug spray that you can make that won't make you smell like a tourist. And for me, I always recommend long pants, long sleeves, even in the dead of summer when it's hot out. Trust me, it'll help you. Always spray your clothing for tick prevention. That's a huge one. It's very near and dear to me. Many of these actually don't have too heavy of a smell, and I wouldn't get too caught up on that. There's tons of stuff you can buy, especially this time of year when hunting gear is coming out everywhere. All sorts of stuff, even deodorant. There's laundry detergent you can wash that has no scent or smell or anything like that. It'll try to wash the stuff out of your existing clothing. You know, brush your teeth, because a lot of it comes out of your mouth. But I'm always weary. She mentions the bent tree stuff. I'm kind of weary about these photographs. Mother Nature is pretty amazing at what she can do to trees in the woods, and it doesn't take a Jenga-loving Bigfoot to restack trees or twist them up and tie them into knots. Sometimes Mother Nature can do that, and even if the explanation looks impossible, believe me, I've seen some wacky things happen in the woods that really seem to defy logic and physics, but we can't always blame that on a Bigfoot. The third thing here, stop and listen. Again, I got a caution on this one as well. If you're in a popular area for Bigfoot investigating, you got to think, and this always comes up every time I'm out with a group of people, what if you run into another group of people out there in the woods that are looking for Bigfoot? Or maybe they're just hollering or screaming in the woods. So maybe you're not face to face with these people, but you hear their calls. You know, how do we know if they're human or not? We don't. So you got to be careful with that, especially going into areas that are inundated possibly with other Bigfoot researchers. And I use the term Bigfoot researcher in kind of a loose tongue there, because their research might be a byproduct of alcohol or other things. And with that, never take one piece of data as true evidence. So if you're hearing something screaming in the woods, you're hearing howls, things that sound really unearthly, you're still going to need other pieces of data to really put it together, to really make anything of evidence. It's not enough just to hear something and turn to somebody else and go, there's a Squatch in these woods. That's not enough. It's not enough. And I think the real key here that I would say with the stop and listen is to really know what to expect to hear in the woods. Know what's normal. That's the big thing. Know what's normal. And believe me, a fox can fool anybody with the array of noises that they can make. But even owls can sound kind of weird if you're not used to hearing them. So get used to knowing what you're going to hear out there, and it should keep you from making assumptions about what's going on out there. But do stop and listen. Talking is great too. Having conversations and being normal. You don't have to be all 007 in the woods and sneaking around. Having normal conversations, but knowing when to be quiet and listen is very important, because all the animals know you're there. Doesn't matter how much you distinguish your smell and how much you hide and crouch down, the animals will always know that you're there. Number five, set out at night. I'm a big believer that this Sasquatch being more active at night or in the dark, I'm a big believer that this is complete and utter nonsense. There's absolutely no evidence to validate the claim that you can only come across a Bigfoot unless you go out at night. I mean, yes, it looks very, very cool on television. It makes for great TV, and it always brings the people back after a commercial. It actually helps sell some cars. So it's very important that we say this, that that you go out at night. But in reality, it puts you at a major disadvantage of the woods. Yeah, it does. You can hear things a little bit better for some reason, but it's not because your eyes are out and your ears are open. Your hearing actually relies on your vision, believe it or not. They're actually tied together. And I learned this years ago because I fight the same fight in the ghost field. That's a losing battle there too. But don't put yourself at a disadvantage, especially in the woods. It increases your chances of getting hurt by falling, as well as misinterpreting the sounds of nocturnal animals. So my advice, and this goes with some of the best trackers in the world, and I've read all kinds of tracking books. I've talked to a lot of people that like to track animals. The best time to go out in the woods to look for any sort of animal is early in the morning as well as late in the afternoon. Early in the morning might be before sunrise, so you're kind of mixing in with the nocturnal animals, but you're also there in the early morning. Now, the reason for this, especially to track animals, is the low sunlight is actually the best light to have to look for tracks, to illuminate the ground at an angle to be able to see tracks. They pop much, much better. If I'm out at night, I use my flashlight down low, pretty much around the kneecap area or hip, between hip and kneecap, depends on how big, you know, how tall the ground is. And it illuminates footprints really, really well. You can see inundations in the ground and game trails and all kinds of stuff a lot better. But you're better off with natural light and not the drink. This will also cross you with the nocturnal animals as well as the diurnal ones, the ones that are out during the day like you and I, and also put you in line with the crepuscular ones. I always have a hard time with that, crepuscular. And these are the guys that are out early mornings and late afternoons. In other words, the animal, again, more active at dawn and dusk or twilight, like deer, bobcat, rabbits, bears. And actually, most wild animals are more active during those time frames other than nocturnal. Nocturnal animals are actually a lot less frequent. So you're better off going, not saying avoiding the nighttime, but if you're going to go out at night, go out early night. Or go out really late night, past Taco Bell time, late night, early morning. It's probably your best bet. This makes more sense to me to be out there when most other species are out there, and especially when they're crossing between the nocturnal ones, when the predators are a little tired and they're getting ready to bed down for the day, and when the crepuscular ones are out in the morning, and your diurnal ones are also getting ready to get up and move around as well. So, best time, I think. That's when I like prefer to go out. I mean, much more sense than waiting for a witching hour. Or would you call it a squatching hour? I don't know. I never heard that before, but maybe there's a squatching hour. All you have to do is look at the reports. Look at all the reports that are out there. Look at the time frames that these things happen. Do most of them happen between midnight and 5 a.m.? No. No. Most of them happen at the time frames I'm suggesting you go out. Believe it or not, just look at these stories. I'll look at the time frames. Use the buddy system. I agree. You don't want to go out alone, and you certainly don't want to split up into groups by yourself. You're at a high disadvantage. Only one set of eyes only one set of ears, and you're better off. But be smart about this. 20 people in a 3-square-mile area, probably not a good idea. Nor would 2 people in a 300-mile square forest. My advice is to bring people who can fill specific roles, such as somebody who knows how to track animals or look for sign, people who can navigate using more than just a cell phone, people that know the area or know where certain markers are or certain things are, where noises might be coming from, people who have access to equipment like binoculars, range finders, FLIR, you know, night vision devices, trail cameras, and whatever else you might need. I'm a fan of the buddy system, but I think you need more than 2 people. And if you've read my book, I suggest groups of 3. And one person out of those 3 is solely focused on navigation and communicating with the other groups, as well as listening to the noise to help the other 2 that are in that group move to a different direction if necessary. That person would also, again, be in contact with the other group of navigators to help the group coordinate to cover a large area of land or to intercept a potential target. That's the way I like to do it. I mean, I could go on and on about my recommendations, or again, you could just pick up my book, Handbook for the Amateur Cryptozoologist, which you can find at paranewsinsider.com in the first paragraph of the homepage where it says 6 books. I feel kind of bad using this story to sell my book, but a lot more great advice in there other than what I've just told you. Granted, the article that I was talking about is actually about the upcoming International Bigfoot Conference, which takes place August 31st through September 2nd, 2018 in Kennewick, Washington. So a great way to put a paranormal conference out there, or I should say a Bigfoot conference, by giving some advice about how to find it. Usually you don't get that, but I really enjoyed that article. I thought it was really cool that they did it that way. And yeah, I can yell like one. I've learned from some great people. I'll tell you, you get some girls out there and they scream, you get some really good reactions from that as well. But I can do some of the whoops and the hoops and the hollers, and got some pretty decent lungs. I'm not the best, but I can hold my own in a Bigfoot calling contest if I got the voice that night. So one more story in cryptozoology, and this might not sound like a cryptid story, but trust me, it is. The Global Wildlife Conservation launched the Search of the 25 Most Wanted Lost Species campaign on April 19th, 2017. Sounds like the FBI looking for specific animals that are causing mischief. Maybe this alligator who ate this woman could be on this 25 Most Wanted Species list. But no, this is the 25 Most Wanted Lost Species. So these species, these 25, have not been seen in a collective 1,500 years. So some of these haven't been seen in 10 or 15 years. Some have been hundreds of years. So all told, all together, you add it all up, it's about 1,500 years, which is kind of a weird way to say it, but that's what they wrote, so that's what I'm telling you. This list includes 10 mammals, 3 birds, 3 reptiles, 2 amphibians, 3 fish, 1 insect, 1 crustacean, and 1 coral, as well as 1 plant. And these are found across 18 countries. Pretty cool list as well. A lot of these I've never even heard of, which is pretty cool to stump me with an animal question. One of these species on the top 25 list, the Jackson's climbing salamander, was last seen in Guatemala back in 1975 and has eluded other attempts to document it. However, on October 30th, 2017, it was officially announced that Jackson's climbing salamander had once again been found after a 42-year absence of observing this creature in the wild. Now, that's wild in and of itself, but now we've crossed one off the list. So now it's down to 24, but now there's reports out of Indonesia that a Wandiwoi tree kangaroo has been photographed. Yes, a Wandiwoi tree kangaroo. You didn't know that kangaroos lived in trees. Well, this is a tree kangaroo. There's plenty of those. There's actually 14 different varieties of these guys. This tree kangaroo is one of the most poorly known mammals in the world, and our knowledge of them stems from a single male specimen gathered back in 1928. Its conservation status is deemed critically endangered, but without any surveys or any other knowledge of this creature's existence, it's thought that it might actually be extinct due to a wide variety of, well, man-made effects. Go figure. We're always in the middle of this stuff. So far, this announcement has only been made online by newspapers such as The Sun, The Daily Mail, and LA Bible. The story goes that 47-year-old Michael Smith was visiting West Papua, Indonesia, and Smith is head of research at a medical communications agency, but he's actually very well versed about being out in nature. He's made another discovery back in 2015 when he found a new species of tulip in Kurdistan. I believe he has a background in biology. So Smith hopes to visit the area next year. We'll hopefully have permits. And this was the highlight of the story to me. He hopefully will have permits to bring back some Wandiwoi tree kangaroo poo to be analyzed and compared to the existing specimen's DNA. That's cool to bring some poo back from Indonesia to prove that an animal exists. The photos, I don't know. Does this mean that the scientists doubt his find? Which, I've talked about it before. I believe one of the last stories was a bird that was filmed. There was another bird on a video shot by a girl that proved the existence of creatures through videos and photographs alone. And people complain, well, why not Bigfoot? Well, Bigfoot is a completely unknown animal. So this is about seeing a known animal in the wild that has specific characteristics that make it different than other animals that are similar to it. Now, Tim Flannery, who has discovered 15 living species of the tree kangaroo. It's what I get for trying to memorize things like that. He's essentially written the book on tree kangaroos with the book titled Tree Kangaroos, A Curious Natural History. I think I got to pick that one up. I'm probably going to put that on my Amazon list for Christmas. He seems to feel that this is definitely it. He says, quote, "This is definitely the Wandiwoi. Everything in this picture is consistent with the only known specimen. It's an extremely significant find. I was amazed when I saw the photographs. I believe it has gone unspotted for so long because it is in a restricted to a single small mountain range," which is, unquote, which is correct. It's regulated to a small mountain range, a small area at a certain elevation. And unfortunately, logging and other activities have cut down the numbers of this Wandiwoi tree kangaroo, and it's not really a highly traveled area. So that's why biologists have not really seen one. They have put out, have tried to find these with expeditions, but they've come up empty-handed over the last 40-some-odd years. But it's going to be interesting to see how the Global Wildlife Conservation Organization reacts and if this creature will be crossed off the 25 most wanted list. Again, cryptids don't have to be Bigfoot, Yeti, Loch Ness Monster, or El Chupacabra. These animals, cryptids, are also defined as missing and not just unknown. So in my eyes, Michael Smith made a cryptozoological discovery, just as much as a biological one. And this story is being carried by some of the cryptid news outlets. It's not everywhere because I think a lot of people don't want to include this as cryptozoology, but this is kind of the foundation of cryptozoology. Animals that are hidden or missing, we haven't seen them in a long time, whether it's 10 years or 65 million years, or creatures that are just so far outlandish that scientists turn their heads away from it and say that's not real. But unfortunately, that latter category is where a lot of people focus. But cryptozoology is all of that. It's animals that we've not been able to find. And this is a tremendous discovery if, and in fact, it is real. And I would say that this is more than likely real. I just hope it's recognized. And again, it's also cool because, yes, he does have a background in biology, but he didn't set out looking for this thing. This wasn't his goal. He had heard about it. He had actually had been there before and knew the stories about this tree kangaroo. So he was aware of this. So when he saw claw marks or scratchings in the trees, he kind of had an idea. Maybe this thing is near. And he did spot it, took some pictures, and other people saw it. So it's a really cool thing that he wasn't actually in an expedition looking for this thing. And kind of holds out hope that maybe other animals like this that have not been seen in a few dozen years or so could also be discovered, like the ivory-billed woodpecker, for example. Is a normal, regular animal that's not been seen in a long time, either in the south here in the United States or in Cuba. But hopefully we've not given up on that one. A lot of biologists and naturalists have given up on that. And a naturalist is essentially somebody without a degree or a field of focus that is out there. So I could call myself a naturalist and get away with it. But yeah, really cool story in cryptozoology. A question in the chat room, why don't national park game wardens make good crypto researchers? I don't know that they don't. I mean, the unfortunate part is if you're working in a national park, you represent the federal government. So a lot of what you say and do is probably pretty regulated and watched, monitored very closely. But I do know that these, when you're talking about national park people that are dealing with things, they're a little bit more open to animals such as mountain lions crossing into the eastern part of the United States versus people who work for the state who are really, really scared about this because if mountain lions are found in a particular state, then that state has to take care of them unless they do the triple S technique, which is shoot, shovel, and shut up, which is unfortunately what a lot of states are doing. But yeah, people that work in these forests, in these woods, whether it's state forests or national parks, which actually have a national park about 20 miles west of where I live right now. Now, these people know what's going on out there. They know the land. They know the animals very, very well. So these people would make good cryptid researchers. And not a whole lot of stuff hidden or missing here in the United States that's big creatures. Most of it's small things. I can tell you that a big discovery was made less than a mile from where I sit behind this mic right now. And I'm pointing in that direction right now, down the street. It's been, I think, about a decade now that a specific amphipod, so kind of a shrimp, was discovered in a cave system very close to where I'm sitting right now and was as one of a kind. There's very few of these out here, and it's very limited to only a few caves in this area. So it's a unique species that was discovered right here in Northeast Ohio, which is kind of cool. I talk about that at appearances and things. You never know when you're going to find something, but these small animals like this, as a generalist, as somebody who knows how to take care of the woods or manage a certain area, you might not have the expertise to really deal with that kind of stuff. UFO news. This is a pretty big story going on right now, but I think it's finally sputtered out. It's landed and it's put back in the hangar. A UFO video in North Carolina has spawned a viral story, a highly viral story that's since gotten the attention of larger news outlets like Fox News. Fox has a headline about this story that says, quote, UFO speculation surges after North Carolina lake video goes viral, unquote. The video was shot over Lake Norman in North Carolina back on May 29th. And despite being extremely shaky, you might want to take something if you get motion sickness before you watch this video. I instantly recognized the purported unidentified flying object. Jason Swing published a video back on May 29th, but it's now gaining momentum. It has now become a viral sensation, even after it was debunked. Yes, this video was already debunked a while ago. This is a spacecraft, are the opening words during the 1 minute and 17 second video. You see that is shouted about halfway through as he points to the sky, where a long and thin shaped object moves slowly through the sky from the left to the right from the vantage point of the viewer. Right as the video ends, Jason says that's all he can get out of it, and he had to go. Not sure what could be more important than filming a UFO and proving it to the world that extraterrestrial visitation is real. And yes, while I did see the video, I did instantly recognize the shape as the Goodyear blimp. Not because I'm some sort of expert UFO researcher or because I look at these videos and photographs all the time. Yeah, I'm sure that helped. And even if I did write a book on the subject, well, there I go again, talking about my books. Shame on me. But the real thing here is that I've got a lot of experience in viewing the blimp in actually very similar conditions a number of times. In fact, I actually grew up in an area where the Goodyear blimp was regularly seen, and has since changed shape and even color a few times. So the one I'm used to as a kid was the old gray one with the black lettering on the side. It had the white tail, white and red striped tail fins on it. But now they're grayish with blue and yellow writing on them. But they're still pretty recognizable. I've seen the blimp randomly over the last 40-plus years. Yes, I'm older than 40. Some people think I'm like 20 years old or 25. No. I'm a little over 40. Barely. Barely. Again, I'm living in various parts of Northeast Ohio. And in the last couple of years, actually 2 years ago, I saw the blimp while kayaking in various reservoirs in the Akron, Ohio area, where the blimp is actually stationed, one of the blimps. And it looked exactly the same. That's why it popped out to me. Wingfoot Lake, that's the actual name of the lake. Wingfoot Lake is where there's a hangar. You can go there and you can fish, you can kayak, you can putter around in a non-gasoline engine powered boat. And you can see the actual blimp right there in the hangar, taking off and landing and doing all kinds of tests. It's really, really cool. Yeah, one of the photos I took while in the water actually ended up being the cover of my book, Handbook for the Amateur UFO Investigator, which was released last year. And that's the last time I'm going to reference my book here tonight on the show. And also, I also follow the Goodyear blimp on Twitter, as this is not the first time it's been mistaken for a UFO, and I've been entertained by their responses to this story. Now, some UFO websites have accused Goodyear of lying about the location of the blimp as leaving the Charlotte, North Carolina area on the Tuesday in question after covering the NASCAR Coca-Cola 600. They claim that the blimp could not have been there and that the shape of the blimp is wrong. Well, they're wrong. Granted, they had an older version of the blimp. It was a different shape. It was not the Wingfoot 1, which was covered at the event, which is actually the blimp that I saw pretty up close and personal a couple of years ago. So Goodyear's response was, quote, A, that's not a photo of our current blimps. B, when you actually compare current photos, you'll see that it is indeed our silhouette. C, there are numerous blimp sightings in the same area on the same day. And D, you're embarrassing yourself, unquote. Well, I would say E, all of the above. So this story serves to showcase an important lesson. While this video came out, many people were jumping on where they thought the object was. Some people said it was a drone. This assumption was based on the fact that the channel that it was being initially carried on had a lot of fake UFO videos containing drones. Some others dismissed the object as a low-flying passenger jet from a nearby airport, and others thought this was CGI, and the object was put in after the fact, while others, and some still, are convinced that this is a genuine UFO. Even for me, I was careful not to settle for my initial impression that it was a blimp. While I felt very strong this was the case, I still looked up the Goodyear blimp on Twitter to see if one of them were in the area during that time frame, and also utilized other searches to see if other people had put up photos of the blimp on social media in that same area and that same time frame. Now, when I saw the blimp was indeed in the area prior to that weekend, to me it served as solid evidence. The size, shape, and what little bit of color seemed to fit that profile. You know, we live in a generation that we can get answers very, very quick through Google and everything else. But this knee-jerk explanation to anomalous videos and photographs and other pieces of information, it's always been this way. People will generally guess their solution based on their beliefs and emotions at the time, while others may use experiences to help gain their thought on this as well. Again, that's why I wanted to cross-reference this with what I thought it was to make sure. We should be careful of assigning a solution based on emotions, feelings, opinions, or other assumptions until we can gather some sort of information that supports one of the possibilities more than another. And along with that, we have to be careful to not just search for something that supports our personal hypothesis and ignore information that might support an opposing viewpoint. Last but not least with this story, always look at these things from the logical, then you go toward the more improbable. Don't just assume, gosh, it's a UFO video, it's on a UFO channel, it's got to be a UFO. You know, assuming this was a cigar-shaped UFO without looking for other explanations, it's just ignoring other possibilities. We can't do that. It could have been anything, but, you know, realizing the shape and everything, going after that and finding the evidence. Passenger jet, to me, was the most ridiculous thing because it was very low, very large, and it wasn't moving that fast. And if it was that close, at that distance, moving away from the person, you would have definitely heard the jets, even on the video. But again, people just make assumptions. And that's not the only video that popped out with this. There was another video that popped up August 19th with similar footage, but a lot easier to figure out what's going on. It was a lot less shaky. And the person actually admitted the day after posting it that it was the Goodyear blimp. I do have... Well, I got one more story. I'll hold the other story I have for next week. But quickly, I have to cover this story. It's very timely here, and it's in Ghost News, and it's on the passing of Michael Persinger, psychology professor and spiritual neuroscience researcher. He's passed away at the age of 73. A majority of Persinger's work focused on consciousness and dove into the world of the paranormal. He was considered a rarity in paranormal research, as he was a regular and established scientist who dabbled in parapsychology and other aspects of spirituality. But he since became known with his work on what went on to be called the God Helmet, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with. The God Helmet was actually first called the Corin Helmet after fellow researcher Stanley Corin. The early helmet, the actual God Helmet, was a yellow snowmobile helmet. Kind of takes out the godliness to it when you learn it was a yellow snowmobile helmet. It was covered in magnetic coils and other sensors attached to computers. While the results are debatable, and I'm not here to question what he did or what he found, by other scientists, early experiments led to people experiencing the feeling of a divine presence, which led to the nickname God Helmet, which eventually stuck. Others who were subjected to low magnetic fields had out-of-body experiences or suddenly remembered experiences as a child or other paranormal experience-like symptoms. Now, a lot of people are like, wow, this must be a lot of energy focused on the brain. You know, did he kill anybody or hurt anybody or maim anybody? Well, no. The magnetic fields were not very overpowering or extremely large, which makes some feel that the suggestibility of the experiment was to blame for the results. Persinger's work is the hallmark for electromagnetic sensitivity, where people state that electronics make them hallucinate or see ghosts, or they become nervous, or other negative feelings or emotions come over them, even mental manifestations similar to haunting experience. Skeptics say that this hypothesis has not been proven by other scientists, but I gotta say, honestly, I've seen this work in the field. I do believe there is some truth to this, but not as widespread as Persinger made it out to be. Either way, a lot of people may not know this, but Persinger is also known for explaining UFO sightings as well. His early work in the 1970s focused on geophysical and electromagnetic principles of seismic activity, helping to explain anomalous lights in the sky as being a natural effect of what he termed tectonic strain theory. The lights in the sky were interpreted as UFOs or other forms of extraterrestrial activity due to the proximity to the event and the temporal lobe of the brain being affected by being stimulated by the release of electrical energy during the geophysical process. And it may sound all technical mumbo jumbo, but trust me, the papers that I've read of Persinger's over the last few days, this is the easiest I can make it sound. Persinger was a great mind who pushed the boundaries of science to explore the unsafe corners or recognized facts, looking for the how the brain and mind could explain paranormal phenomena, and he will be missed. He was definitely a pioneer in paranormal research. With that, you're going to have to tune in next week to find out about the camel. You forgot about it, didn't you, about the camel story? Well, a radio dish is going to be replaced by a camel, but you're going to have to tune in next week to hear about that story. I kind of overbooked myself tonight, but it's time to go. And with that, I'll see you next week. But for now, keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, the hair standing on the back of your neck, and always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.